I noticed it the first time I was right about something. Not the first time I suspected something. The first time I was actually, verifiably, paper trail right. I had the phone record. I had the screenshot. I had the timestamp showing his location as somewhere other than where he told me he was. I sat with those for 2 days before I said anything. I wanted to be sure. I wanted to be calm. I wanted to walk into that conversation as someone who was being reasonable, not reactive, not the kind of person who picks fights over nothing. I didn't need more evidence. What I needed, it turned out, was a different understanding of what the evidence was going to be used for. He cried first. That surprised me. I had expected denial, which I had prepared for. I had expected anger, which I had prepared for. I had even prepared, in some theoretical corner of my mind, for the possibility that he would simply tell the truth. What I had not prepared for was the way his face changed, not in the direction of guilt, but in the direction of injury. He looked at me the way someone looks when they've just been told something that has genuinely devastated them. I hesitated. That hesitation is where it started. He said he couldn't believe I would think that. He said he had trusted me. He said that after everything he had done, after all the ways he had tried to build something real with me, I was sitting there treating him like a suspect. His voice didn't rise. That was the part that stayed with me. If he had shouted, I might have held the phone record in front of him and said, "Look at this, just look." But he was quiet, controlled. He looked genuinely hurt in the particular way that makes you wonder if you've misread something fundamental. He asked me where I had gotten those screenshots. He didn't ask if they were accurate. I told him. I told him I had been checking, because something felt wrong. Not in a paranoid way, I said quickly, immediately softening the word paranoid before he could use it, in a rational way, in the way that anyone would feel when plans kept changing at the last minute and the explanation kept shifting. He nodded while I talked. He let me finish. And then he said that he had always known I had trust issues. He said it gently, not as an accusation, as a diagnosis. He said he knew I had been hurt before, and that he had been patient with that, and that he had hoped we were past it. He said he had thought we had gotten to a place where I could believe what he told me. He looked at the counter when he said it, not at me, and that small act of looking away, that tiny performance of being too pained to maintain eye contact, landed exactly where it was aimed. I started apologizing before I had finished processing what had just happened. The Darvo pattern was named by clinical psychologist Jennifer Fried in 1997. It describes a specific, recurring response by perpetrators when confronted with their own behavior. Deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. Each phase is distinct and sequential, and each serves a precise function in deflecting accountability while simultaneously reorienting the conversation away from the behavior in question and toward the character of the person raising it. The denial comes first because it is the simplest form of friction, not denial that requires evidence, but denial that requires a counter-argument, something the confronting person has to work against. If the denial holds, the conversation ends. If it doesn't hold, if the evidence is too clear, the second phase begins. The attack is not always loud. In fact, loud attacks are less effective because they're legible. The most effective attacks are quiet. They target the confronter's credibility, their emotional stability, their history, their motivations. They reframe the act of raising a concern as evidence of a character flaw, trust issues, insecurity, a pattern of misinterpreting things. The specifics vary, but the mechanism is the same. The problem isn't what you found. The problem is that you were looking. The reversal is where the architecture completes itself. Once the attack has created enough doubt in the confronting person, enough questioning of their own perceptions, their own motives, their own sanity, the perpetrator becomes the victim. Their feelings of being accused, of being mistrusted, of having their integrity questioned, become the primary emotional content of the room. The original concern is still technically present, but it has been relocated. It is now somewhere underneath the perpetrator's injury. To reach it again requires the confronting person to dismiss those tears, that quiet devastation, that performance of being genuinely hurt. And most people cannot do that without feeling like they've become the villain. I became the villain 3 times that year before I understood what was happening. I came to him with a credit card statement. I came to him with a text message that he hadn't told me existed. I came to him with a calendar screenshot and a plane reservation that he had described as a work trip. Each time, the sequence was the same. The quiet injury, the reframing of my act of looking as an act of betrayal, the slow shift in which his distress became the only thing in the room, and my original concern became something I was obligated to apologize for raising. The coffee mug with my name on it had been his gift to me when I moved in. It sat on my desk every morning. I had thought, when he gave it to me, that it was the kind of gesture that meant something, that meant this is yours, you belong here, this space is yours too. I thought about that mug during our 3rd conversation of this kind. I thought about how many times I had looked at it, as though it settled a question. It was settling a different question. He didn't need to shout to make me doubt myself. He didn't need to call me crazy. He didn't even need to maintain the lie with any particular consistency, because by the 3rd conversation I was more focused on not hurting him than on pursuing what I had found. I had learned, somewhere in the months between the 1st confrontation and the 3rd, that the cost of being right was too high. Being right meant watching him become someone I couldn't bear to have caused pain. Being right meant sitting with the sight of him in distress and knowing I was the source of it. Being right meant becoming, in his telling, someone who went looking for problems in a relationship that had been fine before I started looking. So I stopped looking, not because I stopped noticing, because I had understood by then what noticing cost. Researchers who study coercive control have documented this specific mechanism, the way it doesn't operate through fear alone, but through the repeated redirection of empathy. The target of control is not isolated from their own perceptions through cruelty. They are isolated from their own perceptions through care, through the experience of having caused someone else's pain, through the understanding that raising a concern means absorbing his devastation, and that absorbing his devastation is the only way to get the room to return to normal. I stayed for 11 more months after the 1st conversation with the phone record, not because I didn't know, but because the knowing had been so thoroughly reframed that it existed alongside something I couldn't name, a kind of background noise I had learned not to turn toward. I left on a Tuesday. Nothing specific happened that day. I just didn't come back. I kept the mug for a year. Couldn't explain why. It seemed like evidence of something, except I didn't know how to read it anymore. Eventually, I put it in a donation box with some other things and didn't look back when I dropped it off. The pattern has a name. It has documentation. Clinical psychologists can describe it in sequence. None of that makes it easier to recognize from inside it, because the mechanism works precisely on the people who are paying attention, who are trying to be fair, who are unwilling to dismiss someone's visible pain as performance. It exploits the instinct to be careful, the desire not to be the person who caused damage. The only thing it can't survive is the moment you understand that your empathy was the lever all along. Was there a point at which I could have walked away earlier and chose not to because the cost of knowing felt higher than the cost of not knowing? Or is that the wrong question entirely?